Welcome to Rex Factor. This week, James the Sixth. With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the kings and queens of Scots from Kenneth MacAlpin to James the Sixth.
Ooh, that's... here we are.
Here we are. We are at the end. We are at our final monarch in the Scottish series.
What a long journey it's been.
It has indeed. And it's been quite a long journey since our last podcast in this series.
But, I mean, we've got fairly decent excuses.
We've both been rather busy.
Yeah.
Ali, why have you been too busy to be doing
I have been opening up a coffee shop.
Mm.
I say shop is a bit grand, isn't it? It's a cart outside the train station. But... it has nonetheless been all I've been able to do recently.
Because you've literally been building it by hand.
Yes. I can't remember when I had a day off, Graham. I mean, Christmas, but then before then, terrifically busy. You've been swanning around doing nothing.
Really. Well, I've not been setting up any beverage carts.
No.
At the station, but I have joined Ali in the Dynasty Stakes.
Ba-ba-da-ba!
I also have a son and heir.
Congratulations from everyone around the world who listens to our little podcast. Congratulations. Any name?
Well, in true Rax Factor style, he doesn't yet have a name.
Jolly good. Best way, I say. That's interesting that we started this series, you know, footloose and fancy free.
Yeah.
And now it's 8 o'clock bedtimes and and Ovaltine.
And we're also in a new recording studio.
This is also big news, so I wonder how it sounds. It's in my shed at the bottom of the garden.
Yeah.
So we might not have as many motorbikes, which is just a shame.
You know.
I mean, we're as close to a road, really, but it's just... we've just got a couple of houses between.
We've got one final monarch in the Scottish series to review.
Yeah. Who's he again?
It's James VI.
Oh, of course it is.
Or the first of England, of course. He is the first monarch that we are reviewing for the second time.
But, and I absolutely mean this when I say I have no idea what we got last time.
People will believe you.
Really? I just...
The reason we're doing James the Sixth and we didn't stop with Mary is because James the Sixth is King of Scots for a time before he becomes King of England. So we're not going to do anyone after James because we feel we have then reviewed them, even though we could view it from the Scottish perspective. Essentially, we'd just be going over old ground. But with James the Sixth, there is a period where he is King of Scots alone.
Okay.
So he's the last one we're doing for that reason, but there will be some overlap with the English stuff. We'll give him a bit of credit for stuff he does as King of England that might be, you know, impressive. But we maybe won't go into as much detail as we did. So if you want more detail on James as King of England, listen to the James the First bracket sixth episode.
So this is sixth brackets first. Yes. Excellent.
So as it has been a while.
Yes.
A little bit of backgroundy stuff to catch up on where we've been. Last time, over three episodes, we did Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yes.
She grew up in France for much of her life and became the Queen Consort of France.
Oh,
quite impressively.
Coming up.
But before she returns to Scotland, in fact, the year before she returns, there is the Reformation in Scotland, where they switch from being Catholic to Protestant.
In a big way, though.
In a very big way. The Scottish Presbyterian Kirk is rather more austere than the Church of England and its Protestantism. So when Mary comes back and is this sort of Frenchified Catholic queen, they don't particularly like her. She came back in 1561, tried to be... She stays Catholic, but she accepts that Scotland is Protestant.
Yeah.
Tries to find a bit of a middle way, but really her priority is to achieve recognition as the successor in England to Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
Because dynastically, if Elizabeth doesn't have any children, the next in line will actually be Mary, Queen of Scots.
Okay.
And the problem for Mary really came with men. I mean, I suppose literally almost everybody else apart from Elizabeth was a man in sense of the story, but it was her husband's. She married Lord Darnley, which upset a lot of people and proved quite turbulent, upset the balance at court. And then when Darnley was assassinated, Mary married Earl Bothwell, who was thought widely to be the man who murdered Lord Darnley.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a bit scandalous.
It's just awful choice of men, that woman, poor.
So 1567, the nobles took to war, ostensibly against Bothwell and to free Mary, but after Bothwell was exiled, they imprisoned Mary in Lochleven Castle, and at the age of 24, she was forced to abdicate.
I don't think I'd appreciated how young she was, how quickly all that happened.
So, Mary was no longer queen, and instead we have James VI.
Her son.
Her son, right. Indeed. Son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her second husband, Lord Darnley, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley. And he was born on 19th of June, 1566. So when he becomes king in 1567, he is 13 months old.
Gosh, runs in the family.
Much older than his mother by a good year.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, a bit young.
A little too young. I mean, mine's about 13 months old.
Well, do you think he's ready? I mean, he's moving around and taking control of things quite a lot. If he'd swapped the TV remote with a sceptre, he'd
he'd be fine. He can say tea, poo, tractor. I mean, pretty much start paying his way, I reckon. He's not pulling his weight.
But how is he going to look on the card?
Oh, yeah.
Now, I must confess that I forgot to bring my Scottish pack of Heritage limited playing cards, but Ali has an English pack, and I can reveal that the artist has not bothered to do a different image.
I'm never without them, Graham. In fact, I had two packs.
You did?
Okay, so here he goes. Oh, he's cut quite a figure.
Mm.
And from what I remember of his actual face, from when I met him, that's pretty accurate. He's got quite a sort of sharp features.
Hmm.
I mean, what are they playing at with this whole tights and what looks like when Marilyn Monroe had the wind going up her skirt? He's got that effect on a pair of boxer shorts.
She's walking over a drain.
And then a cloak, which needs to be brought back, all you fashion icons out there.
Those cloaks.
And a pretty fancy hat. And that sword is no good for anything, really. Do you know what else we forgot?
What did we forget?
Ding, ding.
Ah, I didn't bring the scandal bell.
Let's see if I've got anything I can make a noise with in here.
I mean, you've got a lot of metal objects in this shed.
I have.
But you probably need to be careful which ones you strike.
I'm eyeing up that mallet. I tell you what, I've got a cup here. Oh, love it. Okay.
Nice. Brilliant. So, James VI is king, but he's only 13 months old.
Yeah.
And he's got the awkward position that his mother is still alive.
What is the relationship there? I mean, I understand mother and son, but they haven't seen each other for...
Well, so she sees him not that long before he becomes king, I suppose.
Right.
But obviously, he's rather young and won't have any memory of this, particularly.
Because he's 13 months old.
He's only 13 months old.
Yeah.
But a lot of Scottish nobles think that things have gone too far with Mary being overthrown. So actually, a lot of people fight to have her restored as queen. And initially, she actually escapes from her prison, rounds up a huge army, and is preparing to take back control.
Mm.
But unfortunately for her, she is unsuccessful. James has been crowned by this point while she was in prison. It's actually the worst attended coronation in Scottish history. Only 5 earls were present. And no foreign ambassadors.
I'm telling you, it was the biggest crowd this nation has ever seen. Apologies.
Now, the first regent for James is a chap called the Earl of Murray. Now, he was an illegitimate son of James V, so he's actually a half-brother of Mary. Oh, right. Now, Mary, as I said, escaped in 1568, but Murray defeats her army at the Battle of Langside, and after this, she flees to England, hoping that Elizabeth I will provide her with some assistance.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for Mary, it's all a bit awkward for Elizabeth, and instead, Mary finds herself under house arrest.
Yes, because of the man who hates her.
William Cecil.
Thank you.
So, the civil wars continue in Mary's absence. So even though she's not in Scotland anymore, we've still got the Marian party fighting against the King's party.
Right.
The Earl of Murray is probably the most powerful figure at this point, but in 1570 he is assassinated when he is shot through the stomach.
Oh, goodness, that's got to be the worst, isn't it?
Well, and indeed, he is in fact the first recorded assassination by firearm in history.
Rex fact. What year is this?
1570. So at least that was something for him to
think about as he writhed around in...
This has never happened before.
Mortal agony. Oh, dear. Ooh.
So he was a controversial figure, but he was the most powerful, so he leaves a bit of a vacuum. The next chap that is put in to be regent is backed by Elizabeth I, and it's the Earl of Lennox, who is the father of Lord Darnley, so James's paternal grandfather.
That seems a pretty safe pair of hands.
Indeed. And he does restore a little bit of unity, but in 1571, there's a raid at Stirling Castle, and he is fatally wounded while seeing it off. Well, dragged back into the castle at Stirling, where little James sees his bloodied grandfather's body.
Oh, gosh, it's a rough time, isn't it?
So the next chap, number three, Earl of Mar.
We haven't met him.
No, and he dies at dinner in 1572.
Of lampreys?
Well, apparently he just dies, but there are some rumours that he might have been poisoned.
Of course. And when are they going to stop this, by the way?
Well,
I mean, actually, I'll just listen to the next series to find out.
The next chap is the Earl of Morton.
Oh.
But he is more successful than his predecessors. He oversees the final defeat of the Marian faction with the capture of Edinburgh Castle in 1573. And he, after that, works pretty hard to restore trade, law and order, royal authority. So at this point, Mary's cause is pretty much done in Scotland.
How many years are we talking about now? Has that been?
So that's, well, 6 years since she was overthrown, okay. 5 years since she escaped.
Right.
Now, James, of course, has not really been an active player in all of this because he's just been a child. And it's been a bit of a difficult upbringing for poor little James, really.
Yeah.
I think his father was murdered when he was 8 months old. Mm-hmm. He was separated from his mother at 10 months, starved of affection as a child. He doesn't really have any relatives around. Briefly his grandfather until he gets pretty much murdered. And he's just a pawn of these rival nobles in this civil war.
Mm.
No one's really actually looking out for him particularly.
So he never sees his mother again?
Never sees his mother again after 10 months.
That is horrific.
Mm. But he also has some difficulties in walking, apparently, James. He blamed the bad milk of his drunken nurse.
Yeah.
For this. The French ambassador who visited him in 1584...
said nonsense, it's good for you.
When he saw James when he was 18, said he never stops in one place, taking a singular pleasure in walking, but his gait is bad, composed of erratic steps, and he tramps about even in his room.
Guy, he's cutting quite a sad figure.
Now, he has an incredibly intensive educational regime.
Mm.
He learns lots and lots of languages, which he excels at. Latin, Greek, French, Italian, Spanish, English, obviously. Also, logic, rhetoric, composition, arithmetic, cosmology.
Oh.
And this is all like in a day that he's sort of going through all of these things. That's his school timetable. And indeed, it was so intensive that he actually said that they gar me speak Latin, ar I could speak Scots. I was speaking Latin before.
I was going to say, you should concentrate on the basics here, because I did not get that at all.
Apparently his party piece was that he could extempore read a chapter of the Bible out of Latin and into French, then out of French and into English. His education is provided by a chap called George Buchanan, who is a renowned scholar. So he provides the rigorous education and the love of learning, and also provides some useful lessons for James. So apparently James, as a young man, had a tendency to sign everything that was put in front of him. So on one occasion, Buchanan got him to sign a document which made Buchanan king for 2 weeks. So when James asked him why he heard reports of Buchanan going around calling himself king, he showed him the paperwork and said, well, you signed it.
Brilliant. I mean, off with his head, but brilliant.
But also, Buchanan is trying to indoctrinate James. He wants him to be the ideal Protestant king, but also the ideal Protestant king for the Kirk. And this believes that the supreme authority lies with the General Assembly, which is the grouping of the Protestant leaders, not kings. And indeed, kings can be resisted by the common weal.
Mm.
James, however, develops independent thought.
Oh, how dare he?
And he believes in the divine right of kings. And in fact, he really goes completely the opposite extreme to Buchanan.
Do you think... is that a result of that education, or is it just in the blood?
Well, I suppose maybe he was actually divined by God, and therefore James was like, no, then
pretty sure I've had a message here.
I'm the one that's in charge. So when Buchanan is trying to teach him some lessons, one is of one of his predecessors, James III, who suffered a rebellion at Louder Bridge, where the nobles arrested him because they weren't happy with how he was governing. And there was a chap, Archibald Douglas, who was nicknamed Archibald's Bell the Cat Douglas. Because when nobles were deciding who was going to act, Douglas says, I will bell the cat, i.e. the mouse that will then go and just test out.
Find out where the cat is.
Yeah, and get it going. So when Buchanan, later in the day, and the lesson for James is that the nobles and the people have a right to resist the monarch.
Mm.
James sees the lesson rather differently. So later that day, Buchanan threatened to whip his breech.
Ooh.
When James was misbehaving, to which James replied, we would gladly see who would bell the cat.
Oh.
James has identified himself with James III as the cat.
Yeah.
I'm the monarch. I'm the supreme power.
Yeah, okay. Good. Oh, this is good. A bit feisty. Like it.
Unfortunately, Buchanan did give James a beating. And when the Countess of Mar asked how he dared put his hand on the Lord's anointed,
yeah,
i.e. his bottom,
yeah,
Buchanan replied, "Madam, I have whipped his arse. You may kiss it if you please."
I like this guy. He sounds quite a lot like my teachers at school.
But it's pretty horrible for young James, because apparently even in old age, James trembled at the sight of a man approaching him who resembled Buchanan.
Oh, I don't like him.
Now, this is his upbringing, but at some point he's actually going to have to rule.
Yeah.
So, the Earl of Morton has been quite a successful regent, but he makes enemies along the way. Now, in 1578, when James was 12, Morton's enemies persuaded James to declare his minority ended.
That's a bit young, though.
It's a bit young, and in reality, it's just an excuse to try and get rid of Morton.
Right.
So Morton resigns as regent, but is then able to maintain his dominance of government.
Right.
So technically, James is in control, but really...
Well, that's quite a good compromise.
But there's still a delicate balance of power.
Mm.
Now then, into the mix, the next year, in 1579, comes a cousin of James's, Esme Stuart. Mm. Now, he is descended from the... Esme Stuart is a chap in his 30s. He's been in France. He's descended from the Lennox family, and he's trying to get the earldom. Mm. But he's actually grown up in France. He's very cultured, very handsome, sort of proper, sophisticated sort of chap.
A bit like us.
He comes to court, and James is immediately besotted with him.
Okay.
Incredible influence. Suddenly he's got a family member, somebody showing him affection, full of culture and all this sort of stuff. He's never had this before.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, Esme becomes something of a figurehead to the opposition to Morton. And so, in 1581, Morton himself is executed.
For what?
Well, he's put on trial for treason and for being involved in the murder of James's father, Lord Darnley.
Is that, that sounds not true.
Well, he probably was.
Oh, okay.
Quite a few of the nobles are actually in on it. Basically, everybody apart from Mary had been in on it, and she was the one that ended up taking the fall.
Poor old Mary.
And he's killed by a thing called the Maiden, which is a prototype guillotine.
Oh, Rex fact.
Which allegedly Morton himself had introduced to Scotland, though that's disputed. So, Morton has fallen.
Yes.
And Esme Stuart is now pretty much dominant. He's become the Earl of Lennox. In fact, he becomes the Duke of Lennox. But Protestants at court are not too happy about this, because they think, here's this Frenchie, Catholic, over. Yeah.
Yep,
influencing things. Where's this all going to lead? They're worried he's going to convert James to Catholicism and maybe try and get Mary, Queen of Scots, back in town.
Okay.
So in 1582, the Earl of Ruthven, who is a hardcore Protestant, leads a conspiracy against Esme. He seizes James while he's on a northern tour.
How old is James here?
He's 15, 16 at this point. And holds him virtual prisoner in Ruthven Castle. Esme Stuart is prevented from getting to James, and ultimately flees home when James is told that Esme's been doing secret correspondence with the French.
Not true, though, presumably?
Well, maybe a bit true, maybe a bit not true. He protests it, but James accuses him of inconstancy and disloyalty, and so Esme goes home.
Oh, that's a real shame, actually, I thought.
And he then dies the following year in France, Esme.
Oh.
Still a relatively young man. He refused the last rites, apparently. He was saying he had become a Protestant.
Oh, right.
And James blames Ruthven and the other lords for hastening Esme's death.
Good.
Anyway, James is thus pretty fed up with the situation and he wants out. So in 1583, he makes contact with Ruthven's enemies, persuades the custodian of the castle to facilitate his escape. James escapes, Ruthven is executed, and now the majority has begun.
Is there any story associated with the escape? Is it just
not particularly exciting one? Yeah.
Okay.
Just open the door and let me walk out without stopping me, please.
Yes, I'm the
fair enough.
King of Scotland, 18, and let's go.
Yeah.
I wish people would do that more when they say they're in prison. Just absolutely assert your authority.
Do you know who I am?
Yeah. Yes, and that's why you're here.
So James is 18 and he's trying to take back control of royal authority, because he's got the Kirk in opposition to him. He's got a lot of Protestant lords that aren't particularly fond of him. He's also got some Catholic lords that are trying to get their own way. So it's quite a dodgy scenario. In 1584, he has introduced the Black Act, as they're known, which is where he asserts the royal authority over the church. So he's named head of the Kirk and is given the right to appoint bishops, which previously were not allowed within the Presbyterian system.
Okay. So he's rebelling against all of his upbringing now.
And he's also able to summon the General Assembly. So he's now trying to be the one that's actually in charge of the church rather than it dictating to him. There's also another Earl of Bothwell.
Right.
This is the nephew of the one that married Mary and...
Not related because he's not...
But not related to James.
To James, yeah.
In 1589, he was found guilty of treason for plotting to seize Holyrood House, but this sentence was deferred. But then in 1591, he's accused of paying witches to murder James. And over the next 3 years, he pops up at intermittent periods, besieging James in various palaces before running off and escaping again. He becomes sponsored by the Kirk as a Protestant champion. And James is kind of always in fear for his safety because he's always worrying that someone is going to try and either assassinate him or kidnap him.
And there's just this weird eccentric on the loose who's followed by a band of witches and...
And Presbyterians.
The stalker. It's bizarre.
In 1593, James was getting dressed in Holyrood House when he found Bothwell outside kneeling with his sword, effectively showing that he'd taken control. James ran off crying treason, found that the door he tried to get into was locked. Yeah. The nobles come in to find out what all the fuss is about. James calms down, and they have a bit of a compromise. So Bothwell will go on trial, be acquitted, be pardoned, and then he'll leave court and stop bothering James so much.
Is this a whole wasps with jam issue?
Well, he does try another rebellion, but James is successful in putting this down, and Bothwell does then go into permanent exile. And the Kirk was still dominant, but in 1597 there was a riot in Edinburgh after rumours of a papist plot. Now James makes quite a clever move. He just leaves Edinburgh completely and goes to Linlithgow and just leaves everybody to it.
It's a good move. Just fight it out amongst yourselves.
Yeah, it's total chaos. All of the more moderate people are like, oof, I don't like this. The Kirk is causing all sorts of problems here. So when James comes back a few months later, restores order, everybody's delighted to see him.
Yeah. Good idea.
He's back dominant. And in 1600, the last real rebellion against him, or the last real sort of kidnapping assassination attempt, is defeated when the Earl of Gowrie tried to kidnap or kill James when they invited him round to his house. James was able to get to a window, alert his nobles who were in situ. Gowrie and his brother are killed, and James can feel relatively secure.
Okay. All right, so now we can get on with doing all sorts of excellent scandal.
Well, in the middle of all of this, James gets married.
Right.
So this is in 1590, 1591. He decided to marry a woman called Anne of Denmark.
Why Denmark?
Protestant, which is good for England and the succession there. They've already got pretty good trade links. Because he can't be marrying all these Catholic people because that will upset the English, so...
And there's no one in England that's an obvious candidate.
Well, he wants... So this is the sister of the King of Denmark, so he needs to be someone of a pretty high status for it to be. Now, Anne was going to come to Scotland from Copenhagen in September of 1590, but terrible storms forced the fleet to return and shelter in Norway. Mm. They weren't able to get across. Now, she was going to go home, but James seems to have convinced himself that he was passionately in love with Anne of Denmark and fancies himself a romantic hero. Mm-hmm. So he resolves to go and get her himself.
Jumps in a pedalo and sets off.
Well, he takes a retinue of 300, promises to return within 20 days, which is a bit ridiculous, and he goes off to Oslo.
Wow.
So Anne was about to go home, and then James suddenly arrived as a tall, slim gentleman with lean cheeks.
Yes, I mean, that's... Yeah, he is.
It's the man on the card. Yeah. She recoiled when he went to kiss her after the Scots fashion.
Oh. I told you they've got links with the French.
But was told that this was merely Scottish custom and he wasn't being overly familiar.
Right.
So, they get married in Oslo because James decides he's not going to inflict a winter crossing on Anne.
And they have to after that kiss, presumably.
Well, indeed. The sermon is preached in French so that Anne could understand, because she didn't speak Scots or English or any other thing. That's a nice little thing. And instead of heading back, because it's winter, he basically just has a nice little honeymoon in Scandinavia.
Oh, nice. In winter?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
It's kind of romantic. They go to stay with her family, so they cross sort of the river, the ice, in horse-drawn sleighs. And he just has a nice time sightseeing, hunting, has a few chats with some philosophers.
Yeah, ooh.
He also gained a taste for drink while he was away.
Right.
Because apparently the Danes had something of an international reputation for drinking at this point. And Sir James Melville noted that he made good cheer and drank stoutly till springtime.
It sounds great. I mean, this is the start of that bloodline, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can see he's starting to be a bit of a merry monarch here.
So after a few months just drinking in Denmark, he comes back home. So, James is married.
Yeah.
He's producing children, and he has ultimately managed to see off all of these various crazy nobles and religious fellows.
Yeah.
But his prime goal, like his mother, is to succeed Elizabeth I in England. The reason that he is next in line, well, Elizabeth is the last of the Tudors.
Mm.
So after Elizabeth, no more Tudors, so it's got to be somebody else. So the next most senior line would be Henry VIII's older sister, Margaret. And by that line, we get Mary, Queen of Scots, and James VI.
Yeah.
So he's got a pretty good claim, other than the fact that his mother is still alive. So after a lot of negotiating in the 1580s, in 1586, we have an Anglo-Scottish treaty of Berwick, where James is provided with an annual pension, and Elizabeth makes a private promise not to prejudice his claim to the throne.
So it's not a promise, but it's not saying you can't be.
It's a bit of a nod and a wink,
yeah,
but it's not quite explicit. The next year, 1587, after nearly 20 years in England, Mary is found guilty of treason against Elizabeth.
20 years!
Which puts James in a slightly awkward position, because as a Scot, and indeed a son, you might expect him to object to his mother having her head cut off.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he also wants to be King of England, so he doesn't want to make too much of a fuss, or Elizabeth might prejudice his claim to the throne.
And has never met her.
So, what he does is kind of make a public show of opposition, but privately indicate that he'd probably get over it.
Oh, gosh. What? It's like Sophie's Choice. This is terrible.
As such, 1587, Mary, Queen of Scots, is executed.
So who's he talking to here? Cecil, really?
Cecil, Dudley, Elizabeth's chief ministers. Yeah. He does write to Elizabeth as well. So, he's not yet, however, got an explicit acknowledgement that he is the heir to the throne.
No, but who else is there?
Well, we've got Arbella Stuart, who is also descended from Margaret Tudor.
But is a woman.
Is a woman, but born and bred in England, which James is not. Early 1600s, James starts to begin some secret talks with Elizabeth's leading ministers. Now, the first one is a little bit of a risky chap, the Earl of Essex.
Oh, hello, where we are.
But when he is executed for attempting a coup against Elizabeth...
I won't hear anything said against him.
He then turns to Robert Cecil, son of William Cecil and Elizabeth's chief minister.
Equally sneaky.
Equally sneaky, but rather more effective than Essex, and really the key allies. Robert Cecil is really the prime minister, in effect. He's the man that really will make things happen.
Right.
And of course, when there's that intervening period where Elizabeth is dead and there is no one in charge, really Cecil's word
Okay.
going to count for quite a lot. So in March 1603, Elizabeth I died, even on her deathbed, not naming a successor.
Was there a grey area there on her deathbed?
Well, there was a suggestion that Robert Cecil suggested to her, the King of Scots, and she made some sort of noise or gesture. But
that sounds so dubious.
You know,
she look. Do you see how she twitched? She twitched.
But she's dead. Someone else is going to make the call, and that person is Robert Cecil. Within 8 hours, James is proclaimed as king. And after a furious 3-day ride, James himself learns that he has been proclaimed the King of England. And James is then able to make a rather leisurely progress down south to England to great acclaim. People are really pleased to see him. They're pleased, basically, there isn't a civil war.
Yeah.
This is an amazing moment. The King of Scots has just become the King of England. His priorities are to secure peace with Spain, because England's been at war with him for 20-odd years, a religious settlement with the Puritans, and to achieve full union between England and Scotland.
Yeah, because then they're separate countries, they just share a boss.
So we've got union of the crowns, but he wants to actually unite them as one state and kingdom.
Yeah.
Peace, he ends the 20-year war with Spain, though this isn't very popular in England.
Because he has to accept terms, or...?
They just hate the Spanish.
Yeah, fine.
And he also takes strong action to pacify the Anglo-Scottish border, which has previously always been very violent and lots of raids, but now it's part of one kingdom.
Mm.
James is able to sort that out. For religion, he holds a conference at Hampton Court, because Puritans are demanding that we have further reform to the Church of England. They want it maybe to be a bit more like the Kirk in Scotland, much more austere, getting rid of some of the Popish elements.
Mm.
James, however, presides over the conference and largely just continues the middle way that Elizabeth had gone along with.
Yep.
And then, of course, we have the Union. He wants to create Great Britain, England and Scotland. So he declares himself the King of Great Britain. He puts various images and seals and flags and whatnot in place, but ultimately neither the English nor the Scottish parliaments are willing to accept merger into one kingdom. So he's, you know, had some pretty decent achievements, but he does also have some struggles. In 1605, a Catholic plot to wipe out the entire court almost succeeded. The gunpowder plot was going to blow up Westminster with everybody inside. It does fail, but nevertheless, it shows that he's still got religious issues to deal with in England. He loses quite a lot of popularity as the reign goes on. He has a lot of disputes with Parliament, because the English Parliament's got a lot more power than the Scottish one.
Right.
And he believes in the divine right of kings and doesn't understand why they keep objecting to everything. And we have Scotland to deal with. Because he is still King of Scotland.
Oh, I see, like admin. Scottish admin.
James does return, but only once.
Oh, right.
He goes back 1617 to enforce some religious reform on the Scottish Kirk. Which he does get through, but they don't like it very much.
The Scots are always... I mean, surely, as soon as you leave them alone and disappear off to France or something, they go and start killing each other.
Well, we'll see, the subjectivity, how well Scotland fares without James in place. However, age catches up with James. Increasingly suffers from ill health. He's got gout, arthritis, kidney stones, all sorts of bits and bob. He falls seriously ill with malaria in 1625.
In England?
In England. He ignored the advice of his doctors, and when he made something of a recovery, he started tormenting them, going, "Ah, you said I had to do this, and I had to do that, and I couldn't do this. Look at me now!"
Yeah, but presumably they're telling him, what you must do is rub a tulip on your nose and then eat a leech.
He feels a bit less smug when he suddenly deteriorates, suffers a stroke,
laughing at him.
And died during a violent attack of dysentery on the 27th of March, in filth and misery, at the age of 58.
Oh, gosh. What a way to go.
Not the most noble of endings.
No.
For James.
No, no, no. Well, there
that,
we are.
However, is the life and reign of James the VI and then James I of England.
All right, well, let's see how he got on.
Battliness!
Now, James didn't do terribly well for Battliness as King of England, and I can't say that I've got an awful lot of battles, even as King of Scots, to really show for James. The only thing I can really put forward isn't, strictly speaking, battliness, but he does become King of England. And thus, he acquires quite a big bit of territory that his predecessors did not.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from, but I think we'd normally Rex factor that bit.
Well, maybe it's more relevant there, but nevertheless, we'll give him this little go. Yeah. It's not easy for him. His claim is based through his mother, who is A, initially, still alive, and then B, executed for treason.
By the country that he's trying to take over,
Technically, he's an alien, so Scots can't inherit anything on English soil, technically. So to actually inherit the soil...
Oh, gosh.
Now, the 1586 Treaty of Berwick, the first draft said absolutely nothing on the succession at all. It was just a peace treaty. So James proposed that Elizabeth would add in that she should in no way directly or indirectly prejudice his title or at any time give declaration of any other.
Well, he wants something concretely vague.
Yes. Okay. Elizabeth didn't find it convenient. to do this, but she does personally write that nothing shall be done to the prejudice of any title he may pretend unto this crown, unless by the said king's unkind usage towards Her Majesty. I.e., as long as you don't kick off a fuss and do anything against me, we won't stand in your way. Now, this that last thing about unless by the said king's unkind usage towards Her Majesty was probably pretty well timed, because obviously the next year Elizabeth has his mother executed, which could well have provoked James into doing some kind of unkind usage.
She is a smart potato, that one, isn't she?
But James plays a pretty canny game. Privately, he's indicating he's on board. Publicly, he makes a bit of a fuss. Elizabeth feels very guilty when Mary is killed, because she, although she did give the acceptance of the order, she claimed that she
Hadn't said actually now do it.
But he fails when he tries to get an English dukedom and indeed explicit recognition.
An English dukedom? He couldn't even get that.
But he thought, maybe if I've actually got a dukedom, some territory, I'm established lord, that's a good stepping stone.
Yeah, that seems quite a reasonable request. But was it just Elizabeth?
Just no.
No, right, okay.
So as we say, he then opens risky talks with the Earl of Essex. And indeed, after the coup that failed for Essex when he tried to do whatever he was doing, he actually had a letter from James on him when he was arrested.
Ooh.
So it's a bit of an awkward one to to deal with.
Saying, best of luck, tally-ho, see you in Windsor.
But as he said, he was more successful with Cecil. And Cecil advised James to employ clear and temperate courses with Elizabeth, as she was adverse to overly much curiosity in her own actions.
I can't understand that.
I.e. she doesn't like people trying to force her into a corner and
do
something. So he's saying, be nice, don't rock the boat, don't expect her to give you too much, and then she'll be happy, and that's probably the best way to approach it.
That's true of life, most people. Isn't it?
So as he said, although Elizabeth never formally acknowledged him, he was acclaimed as king within hours, succeeded without any opposition, and this is perhaps the point, which, as you say, may be more of a Rex Factory thing, but nevertheless, after centuries of warfare, centuries of England trying to conquer Scotland, James, the King of Scots, is now the King of England.
Oh, it happened that way round, that's true.
And he is crowned in England, King of England, on the Stone of Scone, which is the first, of course, the Scottish ancient stone, the first time a Scottish king was on that since John Balliol in 1292.
Because of my man.
Because of Edward I taking it to England.
That is pretty big, isn't it?
That's quite a big achievement. And, you know, for all your Robert the Bruces and your Battle of Bannockburns and all this sort of stuff, when they're comparing notes at the end, James can go, well, you know, okay, you know, I didn't fight any battles and can't hold a sword and I just sort of walk around funnily, but kind of the King of England.
So. And I can say it in about 13 languages, so,
But obviously, no, the argument against him, no battles whatsoever, really, for James. Apparently, he's got a bit of a cowardly nature. He was said to have been so terrified of violence that he wore thickly padded clothes for fear of being assassinated.
And with great reason.
Yes, understandable. But if we compare him to some of his predecessors, he's not the most martial of kings. As you said, in England, he's actually effectively attacked by Parliament for refusing to go to war with Spain in the 30 Years' War.
Yeah, and then he's just sitting there with his bodyguards around him, and the very ground beneath him is set to explode.
And it's actually Spain go to war against James's son-in-law, the Elector of the Palatine. So it's not just, you know, a random faraway country of which we know nothing. It's indeed, apparently 40,000 Scottish mercenary soldiers go off to fight in this war.
That's quite
for the Protestant cause. But James, as king, he's not getting involved.
Have we got anything?
I mean, there are rebellions that are put down and all that sort of thing, but in terms of James and battliness, it's not his bag. He likes hunting, but
it's got to be against humans, really, hasn't it, this category?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I can't see how I can give him anything more than zero.
I'm afraid, despite having made that argument, I have to agree. James the Sixth is not a military man. It's a zero.
Although, I'm not going to change my score. He might make it back in subjectivity.
Scandal. Well, he might make it up in scandal.
Oh, my favourite. I'm readying the... Oh, no, the cup's gone.
Oh, the cup.
Oh, no.
Oh, you've got one.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Well, he does actually have quite a few things here for scandal. Mm. Now, one of them, which might seem a bit unfair, but equally, a lot of people might pick up on this, it feels a little bit off colour that he's quite so ready to acquiesce in the execution of his own mother.
Yeah, and I've been trying to sort of wheedle that out for a while, haven't I? That,
yeah.
I mean, it is his own mother, whether he's met her or not. He must have a desire to meet her, at least before he acquiesces to her murder. Yeah.
He basically chooses the throne of England over the life of his own mother.
And is it a bit harsh to blame him for that, having never met her, and this is the game that they play? They're all at it at this time, though, aren't they? Mary certainly was at it.
Well, indeed. Now, in the 1580s, prior to the Treaty of Berwick, immediately prior to that, Mary is writing to James, proposing that they should be co-rulers of Scotland, and that thus she will come back, and he'll still be king, but they will be effectively ruling together.
Yeah.
She's making this proposal to James. At the same time, Elizabeth is obviously making proposals about the Treaty of Berwick.
So his mum is saying, how about you don't kill me and we rule together? And Elizabeth is saying, how about we just kill your mother?
Yeah.
Okay, right. And that's basically the choice he's got to make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So James writes back to her saying that he will always honour her as the Queen Mother.
Oh, they can communicate.
Oh, yeah, so they're writing to each other at this point.
Oh, right, okay.
So he'll always honour her as Queen Mother, but he signs the Treaty of Berwick with Elizabeth. So it does feel like he's picked Elizabeth over Mary.
Yeah, that next letter would be awful.
Now, when Mary is on trial, he's in that awkward position. So what he does is a little bit cynical. He sends separate ambassadors to England. And his own words, the one to deal very earnestly, both with the Queen and her counsellors, for our sovereign mother's life. The other, that our title to that crown should not be prejudged. So he's sending separate people, some of them to make the public argument that Mary must not be killed, the other one to say, to be honest, if you do kill her, it'll be all right.
Are we to assume then that he's sort of, is he trying to tread a line where both outcomes happen? Or is he, his eggs more in the, it'll be all right basket?
I think he's ultimately, his main concern does seem to be to make sure that this doesn't prejudice his claim to the throne. Which seemed quite dark.
Yeah.
In his defence, he's not seen her since he was 13 months old. He was brought up to believe that she was an evil Catholic that engineered the murder of his father.
And that everyone in this is just pawns in a big...
And indeed, he's fearful that she will probably try and, you know, manipulate things and take his throne away.
In the spirit of fairness, though, I can see Mary's point of view that actually she's still alive.
Yes.
She was... Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
It would be fair to at least co-rule.
Yeah.
I'm going to give him a ding.
I'll
give him a bigger ding. God, that's hopeless. I need the bell back.
Now, you may remember with all the slightly chaotic goings on in Scotland when towards 1603 there were all these nobles doing all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
The last one I mentioned was in 1600 and the Earl of Gowrie.
Yeah.
Now, what happens is that James was hunting near Falkland Palace when Gowrie's brother claimed that the Earl had found some treasure in his house and would James like to have a look.
Oh, right.
So James agreed to go with him. He was lured upstairs only to find the doors were locked behind him and daggers drawn. James struggles with the Earl's brother, gets to the window, calls for help. The men rush in and the Gowrie brothers are killed.
That he's so gullible.
Well, a lot of people think it's a bit odd if you're going to try and kidnap or indeed murder the king to publicly invite him to your own house, because that's definitely going to come back on you.
Very true.
It's also a bit odd, given how paranoid and fearful James is, that he goes.
Yeah.
And observers also note that the reports coming from the king should differ regarding the names of who was doing what to who and when. James owes quite a lot of money to the Gowrie brothers.
Hey, ding, 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 ding.
And indeed, they are of the same of the Ruthven family that had rebelled against him earlier in 1582. So some people think that perhaps this is all a big fat porky pie and James just wanted to kill them and not give them money.
So James goes up into the attic, murders them both, leans out the window, goes, oh dear, I'm in trouble. Come and give me a hand.
Or realistically, he just went into the house and said, oh, can you kill them, please? And then I'll lean out the window. Yeah.
King of Scots, dead.
And to be fair to him, he does say, if I would have taken their lives, I had causes enough. I needed not to hazard myself so.
Yeah, but it does away with the admin, doesn't it? Yeah, I'll give him one of those.
One of the things that you said you knew about James, or thought you knew about him, that he was possibly gay.
Yeah.
This, I think, is probably true.
Right.
We've got a few men.
Okay.
First up is Esme Stewart.
His relation?
His sort of, well, it's not a first cousin, it's, you know.
Okay.
I mean, given that his parents were first cousins.
It's definitely far, allowed.
Far less bothersome than that. A chap, Sir Henry Wadrington, said, persuaded and led by him, for he can hardly suffer him out of his presence, and is in such love with him, as in the open sight of the people, oftentimes he will clasp him about the neck with his arms and kiss him.
Oh, but he's had such a troubled childhood, he's probably really deeply confused at anyone that shows him any affection.
As I said, it's not clear if they actually have a physical relationship, or if James just kind of in awe of this sophisticated figure. And indeed, it's not really consistent with his later relationships, where it tends to be more that James is this slightly paternal figure.
Oh, right.
Taking a liking to sort of handsome young men, as David Starkey said, sort of handsome, firm-buttocked young Scotsman.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It does seem like an infatuation rather than,
Whereas later, he has plenty of favourites who are young, handsome, they rise up in his favour, gets a bit bored of them, and finds another young, handsome man.
That with firm buttocks.
With firm buttocks.
Yay!
To pick out a couple of them, Robert Carr, a handsome young Scot who went down to England when James became king. James made him...
Sorry, I thought that was a euphemism.
He's been down to England. James made him a gentleman of the bedchamber, which sounds like another
such
euphemism.
Such a thing happen?
Yeah. And personally oversees Robert Carr's rather limited previous education. He rises to become James's secretary and later is made the Earl of Somerset. Now, Robert Carr, after he's not exactly fallen from favour, but is no longer James's favourite, had an affair with a woman called Frances Howard. She is married, so she demanded a divorce from her husband, Overbury. Overbury refused, and then refuses James's order to go off and be diplomat to the Bahamas or whatever. Get him out of town. So as a result, he is imprisoned for refusing the order, and he then dies in the Tower of London. This is all fine because it means that Frances Howard and Robert Carr can get married, until it's later revealed that Frances had him poisoned. Now, both Frances and Robert Carr are sentenced to death, but James has their sentences commuted to imprisonment. And it's thought widely that James has to do this because he's fearful that if he doesn't do something for Robert Carr, that Robert Carr will speak up when he gets his moment in public and incriminate James, if not in the murder of Overbury, then perhaps in what they've been getting up to together. Let's meet George Villiers.
Okay, let's.
He comes to the court as a handsome 21-year-old, quickly surpasses Carr, and becomes James' greatest favourite. By 1623, he's become the Duke of Buckingham.
That's pretty, something's up there.
One time when Buckingham was ill, apparently James spent 3 hours by his bedside and sent him regular gifts, including the eyes, the tongue, and the dowsets of the deer that he had killed.
What a lucky boy.
Dowsets being testicles.
Oh, I didn't know that. Right, okay, so instead of grapes, he got all the oval objects of a living creature, put them in a bunch and sent them to him in a gruesome little package.
Yeah.
Oh, love.
One place they say that Ablethorpe Palace in 2004 to 2008, restoration of the house revealed a previously unknown passage linking the bedchambers of James and Buckingham.
That's brilliant. What year was that? 2008?
Yeah.
How did they not find a Great Escape style passage? It must have been, brilliant.
And James, at one point, to Parliament, makes a speech where he said, "You may be sure that I love the Earl of Buckingham more than anyone else, and more than you who are here assembled. I wish to speak in my own behalf, and not to have it thought a defect, for Jesus Christ did the same, and therefore I cannot be a defect, for Jesus had his John, and I have my George."
Oh, that's lovely. So, actually, he might not have cared if the other fella had come out, as it were, and said... you know, we were lovers. If it's sort of public. He's almost setting it there.
He's very affectionate in public. Like, he showers them with gifts and cuddles and kisses and all sorts of things.
But it's just it's just not that final step of saying this is actually happening.
Yeah. Mm. Now, interestingly, with Buckingham, an extra bit of scandal, which isn't really James's scandal, but he was at James's bedside throughout when James was dying. And he applies various poultices and a julep to James against the knowledge of the royal physicians.
Right.
After he dies, the doctors refuse to sign a bill prepared by Buckingham affirming that the treatment he'd given James was safe. Huh. When Buckingham tries to have them dismissed, one of them publicly accuses Buckingham of having poisoned James.
Ooh, hoo, 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 hoo. That is so. What? So his lover poisoned him?
Allegedly.
Oh, how much store can we put by
Well,
that?
Parliament does actually look into it, and various other people he's then accused of murdering. He's criticised.
Other people?
Yeah.
So we've got a serial killer on our hands.
He's criticised, but not condemned.
I'm astounded. So he's done this to others?
Well, again, allegedly.
Allegedly. Crikey.
I mean, he's a very unpopular figure because he's James's favourite at a sort of end of the reign. He's associated with all sorts of unpopular policies. He's probably just a scapegoat.
Well, still, though.
Yeah.
Mm.
So we've got acquiescing in his own mother's execution.
Big.
Having some of his nobles murdered and trying to pretend that they were attacking him.
I'm pretty sure that's true. Big.
And having quite a few potentially gay lovers. One of whom may have murdered him.
Well, that is massive. I love that bit. I mean, we have to give this a scandal, don't we? Because it's scandalous to the time.
Yes. Yeah, we're not saying now that it's a scandalous thing, but for a 17th
century
monarch. I mean, it's lovely.
What's weird is that it's got all the elements for a really big score, but doesn't have one of those big scandals that echoes down the ages.
No, there's no sort of terrible thing there.
And at the time, although it's massive, is sort of known about and joked about.
Mm.
Even the death of his mother.
I mean, I feel like that's probably something which we look back on now and think, well, that's a bit off, rather than something at the time that would necessarily have been.
But it's that whole Game of Thrones thing.
Mm.
This is the game we play. And But I don't think that we could not give that a big score of scandal of perhaps signing away your mother's life. But it's got to be over 5.
Mm.
I think we're heading north of 7.
Mm.
8 is really very punchy. 7.5 or a 7? We're saying it out loud. I think a 7.
Mm.
Because it was scandalous at the time. I mean, it's a lot of fun, but it is scandalous.
Mm.
7.
I think 7. A 7 as well. I think that's the fair score, which gives him a 14 out of 20.
Subjectivity.
He's a very intellectual monarch.
Mm.
In fact, he's really Scotland's first and only philosopher king,
Ooh.
You could say.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, he went to go and see those philosophers on his jollies.
On his jollies. He's a published author, which I think is the only one in Scottish history.
Wow.
He outlines his own theory on the power of monarchy in The True Law of Free Monarchies, and also provides a pragmatic guide to kingship for his eldest son, Prince Henry, in the Basilicon Doron.
Mm. Wow.
He also does a little bit for public health. He publishes a counterblast to tobacco, which he writes is loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs.
Wow, he was ahead of his time.
He was.
That's amazing.
The French ambassador, de Fontenay, said that he is, for his age, the first prince who has ever been in this world. He has three parts of the soul in perfection. He grasps and understands quickly. He judges carefully and with reasonable discourses. He restrains himself well and for long. In his demands he is quick and piercing and determined in his replies. Of whatever thing they dispute, whether it be religion or anything else, he believes and maintains always what seems to him most true and just.
Good.
And we see this in his religious policy. He doesn't like the extremism of the Presbyterian Kirk, or indeed of the Puritans in England.
Hmm.
The Jacobean age is following the Elizabethan age, but it's, again, you could argue, something of a golden age culturally.
Hmm.
In England, we'll give him credit for some of this as well. Shakespeare writes some of his best works under James. We think of him purely as Elizabethan, but under James we've got King Lear, The Tempest, and things like this. Macbeth is written specifically for James, of course, as the King of Scots.
Of course! That sort of stuck out for me when we were doing Macbeth. Mm. Like, why is Shakespeare getting involved? But yeah. Actually, yeah, it's pleasing the monarch of the time.
And indeed, actually, James's demonology work on witches, actually, probably Shakespeare actually pretty much directly quotes from that for the weird sisters, the witches in Macbeth. So Shakespeare uses James as a source.
Oh, right. But wasn't there that fella that was using witches to try and assassinate him?
Yes.
So maybe it came from that as well.
Well.
He said, I've had experience with these little fellas.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
We've also got other theatrical impresarios, John Webster and Ben Jonson, poetry from John Donne, scientific advances with Francis Bacon, masks by Inigo Jones. And then after the Hampton Court Conference, James commissioned a new definitive translation of the Bible into English.
This is big.
This is the King James Bible, arguably the most significant work in the English language in terms of spreading English across the world.
That is true. So when you say he has published, it isn't in a sort of the kids gather together to produce a poetry book that only the parents will buy.
Yeah.
Probably the most successful book of all time.
Now, obviously, James doesn't actually write it and translate it himself.
Oh,
although he does do a bit of translating of Psalms. I'm not sure if it actually makes it in. But nevertheless, he does commission this incredible work. It is from James that it gets done.
Yeah, yeah. It's got his name on it.
It does literally have his name on it. He's got his face inside, I believe. There's a picture of him at the top showing him as...
Oh, I've seen that. Mm. And there's... Yeah, it's a great picture. And down the bottom, there's people who aren't reading it and they're all confused and off in hell and stuff, yeah.
So that's quite a big cultural legacy.
Mm, yeah, quite big.
Against him, James is actually a bit indifferent to his golden age.
Mm.
So he slept during plays. And when Francis Bacon presented him with a great scientific work, James said that it passeth all understanding.
I mean, you're never really aware when you're living through a great time, are you? I mean, imagine sort of people in the 60s weren't necessarily realising they're on the cusp of a wave or something, but...
But James is not perhaps always the life of the party. De Fontenay again said that he dislikes dancing and music and the little affectations of court life, such as amorous discourse or curiosities of dress, and he has a special aversion for earrings.
I thought he was a prototype Charles II.
No. He's an intellectual, not a party animal. He likes drinking and making rude jokes, but probably doesn't want to read a play.
Huh. Surprising. Mm. Okay. Well... Are you going to read us some of those poems in the Privy Council?
Maybe. Okay. That'll be a treat for you later.
Yeah.
One of the big things for James in Scotland is achieving some kind of control over religion.
Yes.
And the Scottish Kirk was a direct challenge to the predominance of the monarchy. It was instrumental in the downfall of his mother, Mary Queen of Scots. It had backed the Ruthven regime in 1582, which imprisoned James.
Mm.
So it's quite a seditious element as far as James is concerned. So he tries to get some control over it. We mentioned the Black Act of 1584, which made James the head of the Kirk, so he can now appoint bishops, he can summon the General Assembly. This is all legislation to show that actually the Crown is at the heart of the nation, not the Kirk.
Yeah, which is incredible given his background and how quickly he established that.
Now, it doesn't go without opposition. 1592, Parliament recognises Presbyterians' preferred system of government, and 1596 was when Andrew Melville called him God's silly vassal.
Yeah.
And he asserted to James that there is two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is Jesus Christ the King and his kingdom the Kirk, whose subject James the VI is, and of whose kingdom not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member.
How did he survive with his head attached to his body?
Well, at this point, the Kirk is powerful enough that James is not able to just off with his head.
Okay.
That's what James is dealing with. He's dealing with an organisation, religious organisation, that sees itself as above the king.
And is incredibly open in it.
Now, as he said, James was able to exploit that anti-Catholic riot in Edinburgh to sort of demonstrate that actually all of these extremists are causing lots of problems. He leaves town, comes back a few months later, everyone's really pleased to see him, and he's then able to take some firmer action against them. And he is able to start taking some action after this. 1605 to 06, the General Assembly in Scotland met without his approval, because technically he's meant to call meetings of the Assembly. When some of the ministers are put on trial, they declined to appear before the Privy Council, claiming that it wasn't competent to judge on ecclesiastical matters. It's a little bit Thomas Becket and Henry II, really. James had six of them tried for treason, and they are banished for life.
Well, still, that's a compromise, isn't it? Others would have removed the old head.
1609, indeed, the name Presbytery was abolished as being odious to His Majesty.
Ooh.
In 1611, the Court of High Commission for Province of St Andrews and Glasgow is established, which was kind of a final nail in the coffin of the Presbyterian system. It's really getting that system of bishops and dioceses and that sort of thing.
So, good.
Done pretty well there.
Yeah.
He also does some work to restore law and order in Scotland, which was, quite frankly, in need.
Yeah.
As I said, his father had been murdered, his mother was exiled, the nobles are fighting each other, we had a civil war, the Kirk is anti-monarchy, we've got almost no royal authority in the localities, the borders and the highlands are pretty much ungovernable for central government.
His grandfather had it in front of him.
It's all quite chaotic. The borders between England and Scotland are now refashioned as the Middle Shires. Because James doesn't really want there to be a border as yeah. such, he wants it to be one country. He sets up a joint border commission in 1605 to root out the border reavers, the troublemakers. 79 are killed in the first year of this operating.
Mm.
And hundreds are either killed or transported in the second year. Right. Which is not perhaps, looking back, you know, something which we would celebrate in terms of how due process should take place. But by the 1620s, they're pretty much able to pare down these operations because the borders have actually now become quite stable and peaceful and right. settled, which has not been the case for...
Ever.
Ever, yeah.
Previous monarchs that we thought were powerful in Scottish terms now look like nothing when you see that he's now king of the entire island.
Yes.
And is just, right, let's sort that out.
And that's the key thing, because previously, of course, the border reavers, the people on the raiding on either side... could just side with the other people.
Yeah.
Whereas now, James is both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah. It's big. It's good.
It's good. For the Highlands, in 1609, he enacts the Statutes of Iona, where the chiefs, all the various clans, have to send their sons to be educated in the lowlands. So they're going to learn to read and write in English. So he's trying to sort of stamp out this...
Well, there's a law,
law that they have to go and do this.
Okay.
They also made legally responsible for the behaviour of their own people, i.e. if there's any violence and fighting going on, because you've still got a huge amount of violence and blood feuds and this sort of stuff.
Mm. Right, so they seem to be like the final islands of old Scotland in the Highlands there.
Yeah. Now, whether or not you see that as positive subjectivity, you could, of course, also see this as an assault on the traditional Gaelic way of life. I suppose when we're judging the monarchs, we're judging them by their ability to kind of
impose power,
which is what James is trying to do here. Not hugely successfully. It's not solved by any means, but it's probably more stable again than it's been for quite a long time.
But it is interesting, though, that we're now viewing this Scottish monarch in terms of treaties of Hampton Court and all this kind of stuff, rather than running off into the Highlands and viewing them as a basis of power.
Yeah.
It's turned on its head in, I don't know how many years, 20 years, 30 years. Something.
And the key thing for Scotland, really, here in subjectivity, is that he succeeded really where Mary failed in terms of going for that religious tolerance.
Mm.
And he achieves greater internal stability because of the borders and being King of England and Scots, whatever. Scotland is at peace for really, after the civil wars of his regency, for the entirety of his reign.
Yeah.
No war with England. They don't get sucked into any of the European conflict going on. There's no more civil war, which we have in a lot of the European countries. The Earl of Kelly says, as he lived in peace, so did he die in peace.
Yeah. If we're to look at what this category is for, would you like to be a subject under him? Definitely.
And particularly when we compare to his predecessors. I've got some little stats for you here. From James I, who came to the throne in 1406, to James VI, when he reached his majority in 1583, that's seven monarchs, 177 years.
Mm.
96 of those years have been spent under a regency.
Gosh.
That's 54% from James I to James VI becoming his majority. 54% of that time has been minorities or regency governments.
My word.
The average age of accession for these monarchs is 6 years old.
Just because they kept getting bumped off. And what that doesn't reveal is that the deaths of those regents, like with James himself, had, what was it, three or four?
Apart from James V, all of James's predecessors died by violent means.
Mm.
And James V dies after a bad defeat to the English. In contrast, James VI dies in bed at 58... and is succeeded by his 24-year-old son.
Yeah, that is. They are truly impressive statistics. I mean, truly damning statistics for the Scots. And
you know, we get obviously James got a zero for battliness, but it's quite useful for the benefit of the nation for the monarch not to get himself killed in his 30s in a grand futile gesture. Actually, just staying alive and keeping everything going.
Yeah,
not bad.
We said that it might come back to his benefit in subjectivity.
Mm.
And, you know, we have to review each one on its own merits and its great subjectivity. But he seemed to do all of his battliness by not doing it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He did by not engaging in all of the nonsense that came before and just concentrating on this. He got there. And it's good. It's really solid. What I mean is I want to give him some more points in this because of what he didn't do
in battliness.
Yeah.
There are some points against him in subjectivity.
Okay.
We mentioned before demonology and witches.
Yeah.
Well, witches is a thing for James, and looking back, it's not perhaps the most enlightened, which is surprising for an incredibly enlightened monarch.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a stain against his name.
He just knows the word witches in 13 languages instead.
Legislation has been in place since 1563 against witches, but it's basically not been used at all. But we recall that there were storms preventing Anne of Denmark sailing across to Scotland, and indeed there are storms when James come back, and the blame falls on a coven of witches in North Berwick. So, in 1591, witches are put on trial for raising storms against James and indulging in perverse rituals with the devil.
Wow.
One of them, Agnes Sampson, apparently took James aside and told him the very words which passed between the King's Majesty and his Queen at Oslo in Norway.
All right. Presumably I do. Oh, how did you know?
So, 1590 to 91, over 100 witches were investigated, many of whom are burnt.
Mm.
Then there's a great Scottish witch hunt in 1597, about 400 put on trial and something like 200 executed.
So weird.
James personally supervised the interrogation and indeed torture of some of these witches.
Personally?
Personally. Not all of them, but some of them.
No, but some.
And indeed, although there's been some debate about how many were actually killed, nevertheless, probably more witches are burned in this period than religious martyrs are made.
He's just got his own little battle. He's got his own religious martyrs.
Yeah, and indeed, he does see it as an aspect of theology. So in 1597, he publishes a book, Demonology, which is a study on witchcraft, historical and contemporary. It talks about divination by demons and werewolves and vampires.
God, what a waste of time.
After this, he does grow a bit more sceptical. He wrote to Prince Henry that most miracles nowadays prove but illusions, and ye may see how wary judges should be in trusting accusations.
That's what's so weird. He's quite enlightened there. That this is, you know, best part of 500 years ago, and he's saying how they come across as illusions.
Mm.
Yet he's burning witches.
It's almost like he sort of burned a few hundred witches, and then he's like, you know, on reflection,
there's still storms.
I'm not sure there's anything in this.
Mm.
Scotland has got a perennial problem with money. Income from land is falling while the cost of government is increasing. But James himself apparently seems to have been weirdly incapable when it came to finance. He's good on the old philosophy, but numbers were not his bag. He was incredibly generous to all of his firm-buttocked favourites.
Often
to the detriment of the precarious royal finances.
Right.
And he's not really willing or able to change his ways.
Oh, I'm really conflicted with him.
1590s in Scotland, he appointed a group called the Octavians to sort out his finances. So sort of eight ministers who are meant to just come in and sort things out.
Yeah.
And it seems quite modern in a way. They suggest swingeing austerity cuts, big changes to the royal household, lots of people are laid off. But James's favourites don't really like these suggestions at not spending lots of money giving them presents. And they're discredited by a sort of association with that anti-papist rebellion or plot in Edinburgh.
So it is like getting
brought down.
The accountants in Price Waterhouse come in and say, these are where you can make some money.
Mm.
And the vested interests say, no.
No. Hey, I think these guys might be Catholics.
Oh.
So it doesn't really work.
Mm.
In 1600, at the baptism of Prince Charles, who becomes Charles I, the guests were asked to provide their own provisions.
To bring your own?
Yes, and that's not just beer. That's like venison and wild meats and food.
So he's really hard up. Is this after he becomes King of England?
This is before he becomes King of England. So indeed, from 1603, James is rather more wealthy. He's now able to pay. The nobles in Scotland are enriched to an extent that's not been seen since the days of David the First.
Because this is English money going north of the border.
Yes, and indeed, because James has now got his royal household in England and is much more wealthy, Scottish revenues can actually now stay in Scotland. Now, one criticism you might level against James from a Scottish perspective is that he just abandons them.
Yes.
1603, he leaves Scotland and he makes a speech saying, "Doubt not, as I have a body as able as any king in Europe, whereby I am able to travel, so I shall visit ye every 3 years at the least, or ofter as I shall occasion." In reality, he returns just once, 14 years later in 1617.
And he's saying this, "I have a totally able body," as he hobbles off.
Yeah. And he only comes back just to bring the Kirk to heel with sort of slightly dubious success.
Why is that? Does he just enjoy life in England, or is there too much to do?
Well, he says himself that he was swapping a stone couch for a deep feather bed.
Yeah.
And although we do have the gunpowder plot, he's not at risk from being imprisoned by his nobles in England.
Doesn't always happen, though, does it? I'm just thinking about George I, who chose to stay in Hanover a lot.
Now, in James's defence, despite the fact that he's absent, he's not completely abandoned Scotland in terms of his thoughts. So he does ensure the governance of Scotland. So we have the Lords of the Articles who are kind of running the country. James chooses the bishops. The bishops choose the nobles, and the nobles choose the barons.
The bishops choose the nobles?
Not who will be a noble, but which nobles will be on the governing committee. So James is basically deciding who is going to rule in his name. So he's got the people in place that he wants to be doing it. And 1603 to 1625 is probably about as peaceful as Scotland has been for centuries.
Well, yeah, ever?
Now, you might say it's a bit damning that the point at which he isn't in the country anymore is the point at which it becomes incredibly stable and well-governed.
Yeah.
But equally, you can say, look, he doesn't even have to be there. So he died quite smugly in 1607, said, "This I must say for Scotland, and may truly vaunt it. Here I sit and govern it with my pen. I write, and it is done. And by a clerk of the council I govern Scotland now, which others could not do by the sword."
Very true. I mean, that's him putting to bed any battliness argument, isn't it? I mean, he might have written that for us.
Don't need it, mate.
Yeah.
Pen is...
Have you written that yet, Shakespeare? No. Oh, damn it. Did Shakespeare write that?
I don't know, actually. Interesting. Finally, against him, one might argue, his big project, really, when it comes to England and Scotland, is the creation of Great Britain.
Yeah.
And he doesn't manage it.
No.
He saw himself as a sort of a second Constantine who would unify England and Scotland into a single state. There'd be one parliament, one church, one economy, one legal code. And he's at the centre of it all. He assumes the title of King of Great Britain, restyles the royal coat of arms with the lion and the unicorn.
Yes.
Insists on a new flag, which is the Union Jack.
Right.
Which is, of course, Jack being the Latin for James.
Ha!
Jacobus.
Wow. Rex fact.
He brings lots of Scots to court in England. So apparently 4 out of 10 council at Whitehall, 1/5 of the Privy Council are Scottish, 8 out of 20 of the Order of the Garter are Scottish.
That seems fair.
And the bedchamber is entirely Scottish at first. So, you know, we've actually got a merger of English and Scottish people.
Yeah. Do they get on?
The English don't like all these freeloading Scots coming down and being given all this money, as they see it.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they are there. But the biggie is whether he can actually make it legal, and he is not able to do so. Scotland fears being turned into a conquered and slavish province. So they think, I know you're Scottish, but basically this feels just like the days of Edward I, where we're just going to be effectively part of England.
Yeah, it doesn't help that he never came back, came back once to sort stuff out. If he'd have sort of started basing the capital in Berwick instead or something.
So the English aren't very, the Scots aren't very keen because they are pretty suspicious about what it will mean for their position. And England don't want it either. They fear they're just going to get flooded with cheap Scottish goods and people. James tried against it. He argued it was impossible for him to rule two countries at once. And he sort of says, you know, man cannot have two mistresses. It's much easier just to be married.
So, Lord, they try.
Hath he not made us all in one island, compassed within one sea, and of itself by nature indivisible?
Yeah.
Legally, though, he comes a cropper. The House of Commons has a look at it and says that the English and Scottish systems are very different. The Scots are only really just starting to codify their legal system. So they decided the only way it could possibly work as one nation would basically be to extend English law over Scotland.
I bet they did.
Which the Scots aren't going to be terribly pleased about.
So they've come back saying, too much admin, mate. Well, that's poor.
James tries to say, you know, that we don't have to be there straight away. You know, you have to have a courtship before the marriage. Yeah. I'm sure we can move the way along. But ultimately, he is just reduced to symbols and making minor changes, such as removing prejudicial legislation against the Scots.
But that is something that is more than there has ever been.
The idea of Great Britain does survive. And in 1707, it does become a reality with the Act of Union.
Yeah, very good. Very, very good. I'm struggling to see how this isn't a 10.
I guess you've got his sort of struggles financially. You've got some of the witchcrafty stuff. You've got...
Yeah, witchcraft stuff isn't good.
You could also argue with his... Although this is kind of... Well, in England, his arguments with Parliament, but actually in Scotland, the conflict with the Presbyterian Church, you could argue that he's setting up some pretty big issues that will be enough to scupper the reign of his son Charles I.
Yeah, but it's like not blaming the son for the father's sins and vice versa. Yeah. And, I'm just trying to see it in its purest form again. I would be happy. I'd be happy if I were English. I'd be happy if I were Scottish.
I guess another criticism that is made of James is that it takes him an awfully long time to come to grips with Scotland. And actually, we mentioned the contrast with all of his predecessors who die so young, but actually, they all pretty much, well, I suppose you could argue apart from Mary, apart from James III, but actually they all kind of take control young and successfully and really stamp their authority.
Until
they come a cropper. We think of like James II that comes king pretty early, and then he's got a rival noble, he just stabs him and then defeats that family in war. And then he's all powerful. James VI, it really takes pretty much up to 1603. And you wonder how successful a King of Scots he would have been if he hadn't suddenly had the resources of England thrown in. Now, he managed things very well to become King of England, but arguably up to 1603 he's actually been less successful than his predecessors because he's struggled so much.
And it's really that part that we have to judge him on.
But, of course, he becomes King of England and is then able to provide the stability to Scotland.
So, as far as scoring this, are we doing it mostly on the Scottish stuff?
Yeah, mostly on the Scottish stuff. I think he still deserves credit for things like the King James Bible, for example.
I'd forgotten that. I really want to give him a massive score on this, and I've said about the battliness thing as well. I will take it down a notch, and I'll say 9, but I'm sticking with a 9.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking around a 9. I was sort of between 8 and 9, which I suppose leads me towards 8.5. I think it's just, which I maybe haven't put across so well at all just now, but that sense of him struggling with Scotland. And the counter-argument is, of course, well, he does become King of England, and then he is able to make it all fine and sort it out, and that's all good. But
it's we've got to look at that window.
That window, he's a bit lucky, perhaps, that he does get to become King of England, because I think without that, I think he would have been okay in Scotland. I don't think he would have been overthrown or anything like that, but he's definitely benefits from that coming in. But there is still an awful lot of good stuff in there.
There's an awful lot of good stuff. And when you consider predecessor
and how bad things had gotten under Mary, you know, really almost at the point where you're starting to think about, will the monarchy itself survive as a
and
force?
He doesn't throw his lot in one side or the other.
So yeah, it takes him a long time to come to terms with it, but maybe it was actually a tougher challenge than his predecessors had faced.
And the only victim was his own mother.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll give him a 9 as well.
Hey!
That's an 18.
That's massive.
Subjectivity. Longevity. So he is King of Scots from the 24th of July 1567 to the 27th of March 1625.
That's a terrific time.
It's 57.67 years.
Yeah, that whole becoming king at 13 months is really, really helpful.
And not getting killed. Anyway, it's pretty good within the context of the island. Within the context of Scotland, that is the longest reign
yeah.
in Scottish history. So that's a 20 out of 20 for longevity.
Saved it up till the end.
Mm. Dynasty, not the program. He has two surviving children, which gives him a score of 4 out of 20. Tragically, Prince Henry, the eldest son, dies at the age of 18.
Mm.
And he was like the great hope for the next generation. He was quite beloved by the people. He was a Protestant champion. He was very athletic, quite military-minded, seen as this sort of cultural patron, real hope for the future, but died. And then, of course, it went to the sickly, not-so-impressive, not-so-capable Charles. History could have been very different had he been succeeded by Henry the Ninth instead of Charles
the First. Henry the Ninth, wow. Mm.
Anyway, 4 out of 20, so that's 56 for James the Sixth.
Wow.
So 56 will put James in 7th place overall.
Very good.
That pops in between William the Lion, who didn't get the X Factor, and David the First.
Who did?
Who did.
Okay.
So, 56, very good score.
Great.
Top 10 for the Scots overall, but does it mean that James the Sixth has that certain something, that lasting legacy, that great quality, that... Oh, I've mixed them up. Does he have the... Rex Factor! He does become King of England.
Mm.
He does bring a lot of stability to Scotland, arguably only because he becomes King of England, but nevertheless he does it, at a time when Scotland had been so unstable and the monarchy under such threat.
Mm.
He got some good scandal in there as well. He's this intellectual monarchy. Something different, I suppose, is another thing. He's different to the other kings of Scots.
I don't think it's possible to not give someone the Rex Factor who inherits another crown.
I mean, that's... You know, in terms of things to put on the mantelpiece for a Rex Factor winner, when they're all comparing on the Rex Factor mountain their achievements, if James can come along and go, oh, here's the Crown of England, and oh, you know, that stone of Scone you guys used to sit on, I got that as well.
Yeah. Bought and that back. What's that in your pocket? Oh, it's light reading. I wrote this myself. Have you had King James Bible? Yeah. Okay, done that. Fine. And it was that way round as well. I know we said that was important to making it palatable to the Scots, but all of this time in history, if you were to read back when you were living through his reign, you'd definitely assume that if the island were ever to share a king, it would be an English king taking the Scottish throne. So however he did it, it's impressive.
Mm.
And it was that way round.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a yes from me.
Now, it's interesting because he didn't get the Rex Factor as King of England.
Really?
But of course, as King of England, we wouldn't have given him any credit for all the Scottish stuff. We wouldn't have given him credit for becoming King of England, particularly.
Oh, right, yeah.
So did in we England, not? Well, we'd have focused more on the parliamentary disputes and issues that he has later on in his reign, which we've not done here because it's not really that relevant to Scotland.
Yeah.
But when you see it from a different perspective, when you see it from the Scottish perspective and all of the period where he's King of Scots, even though he struggles a bit in that period, actually the achievement for a King of Scots that James shows, I think...
Yeah.
Is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the King of Scots becoming King of England and all the challenges he faced as a 13-month-old, you would not have imagined that he could have risen to such heights.
Yeah.
Didn't do it by the traditional means, i.e. by the sword, but that's what James has got. He had something different to his predecessors of Scotland. I think he deserves it as well. It's a yes from me.
Excellent. Well done, James. Brilliant news.
So James the Sixth does have the Rex Factor. That's 13 Scottish monarchs on the Rex Factor Mountain.
Good luck.
So that is it for the main part of this second series of Rex Factor, the Scots. We have reviewed all of the kings and queens from Kenneth MacAlpin to James VI. Of course, we've not finished the series.
No.
Because like in our first series with the English, we now will have the playoffs. The 13 Scottish Rex Factor winners will be set off against each other and we will find out which one of them will be crowned the Scottish Rex Factor champion.
I'm looking forward to the grand final.
It's going to be fun. But in the meantime, let us know what you think about James the Sixth. Get in touch with us on social media, Twitter at Rex Factor Pod. Like us on Facebook and join in the discussions there. Email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com and go to WordPress, rexfactor.wordpress.com, to complete all the various polls and whether or not you think each monarch deserves the Rex Factor.
Yeah.
If you'd like to support us, you can leave a review on iTunes.
Very helpful.
Subscribe. You can make a one-off donation on PayPal if you'd like to give us a little bit of a one-off treat financially.
Thank you very much.
Joss Waller, Gene, Rick Bjerstrom, Matthew Orr, and Sally Beaton have all done so since last
time. Thank you very, very much.
Very lovely of you. If you would like to support us on a monthly basis and join our Privy Council, then you can click the Be My Patron link and you can get various rewards. Everybody that pays us on a monthly basis gets to listen to the Privy Chamber podcast, mm-hmm. which Ali and I record after the main episodes, where we go over some of the notes and stuff that I didn't put into the main episode but thought would be fun to share. Have a little bit of a lighthearted ginwag.
And it's just us chatting about, you know, we're just chatting. And then there it is. But I like it. It's fun. It's relaxed. It's good.
And everybody gets that. If you do $5 a month or more, you get free access, apart from the $5 a month, to all of our special episodes,
yeah.
which usually cost $2 a time. $10 a month, you get a mug. $15 a month, you get to commission a blog on the subject of your choice. Mm-hmm. And $25, you get to commission a special episode.
Yes.
And which we've recently done one on Bess of Hardwick. Well, recently. The last thing we did was one on Bess of Hardwick, Elizabethan matriarch. She, of course, is the one that brings up... Arbella Stuart,
is
James's
she?
Potential rival for the throne.
And looked after her mother, his mother.
Indeed, Mary Queen of Scots. So quite a useful one in terms of the context of the Scottish series. And we have some Privy Councillors to welcome.
Hello.
Sarah Conrath, Laura Pyle.
Oh, Sarah Conrath, yeah.
Mira Form, or Myra Form, Mira, Myra. Funky Caravan, Sword Days, mm-hmm. Susan Shewell, Jean, Meg Vansill, Hind 37, Swanson Betsy, Trister, David White, Neither Deweza, Tristan Ingle, Michael Hallett, Father Gilgamesh, and Thomas Say.
Arise, Privy Councillors. Thank you very much. Sarah Conrath has been active on Facebook for ages. That's great to see her in the chamber.
Indeed. We got a message from one of our new Privy Councillors, not new in this list, but Trish McFarlane. Mm. She says that Rex Factor has quickly become my favourite podcast and keeps me entertained on the long commute.
Thank you.
I've been known to laugh out loud, particularly at Ali's wonderful exclamations, horseradish sauce being my current favourite.
But that's, I tell you, if you get that into your lingo, it is very useful.
I still don't see why Edward I is so great.
Oh, whatever.
Perhaps the special episode will persuade me.
Yeah.
Now, Alex Thompson got in touch about James the Fourth.
Yeah.
Another Rex Factor winner.
What was his standout thing?
He was the hobby dentist.
Okay.
And all that sort of fun stuff. Now, he actually has quite an important spiritual legacy that we failed to touch upon.
Right.
Alex says that in 1494, he ordered a friar from Lindores Abbey, which is now a whiskey distillery, to produce him aqua vitae, the Gaelic for which is usque baia.
Oh.
And what we now call... whiskey.
Oh, that sort of spirit. Got it, got it, got it.
This is the first recorded reference of spirit production in Scotland, and thus James the Fourth is the first known whiskey drinker.
Wow. That is, I mean, we should have included that in subjectivity.
Mm, yeah.
Hmm.
It's another thing to add to his quirky list of interesting achievements.
That's why I like dentistry. He gave them a little nip of whiskey and said, you'll be fine.
Now, when we had Mary Queen of Scots become queen at the age of 6 days old, you asked about whether there'd been any monarchs in the womb.
Did I?
You did.
Okay, right.
And you're going to be
take your word for it.
On the edge of your seat to find the answer out. Bree Jensen, at Bree Jensen on Twitter, said there was a monarch declared in the womb, Shapur II, in 310 AD of the Sassanian Empire.
Oh, right.
Was in the womb. And Antony Baker and Douglas Thompson both pointed out that John of France was born after his father died. Father Louis X died. So he was in the womb and then born to become king.
Waiting to meet the king. That's a strange idea, isn't it?
And finally, Sarah Conrath.
Aha.
Now, a number of people got in touch about this on Twitter and on Facebook, but I've just gone Sarah's one. People quibbled with our scoring for Mary Queen of Scots in relation to Scandal.
I thought we were trying to be really fair there.
Well, so this is what she said. Even though I agree with you that much of Mary's scandal wasn't exactly her fault, it's also true that she was scandalous at the time.
Yep.
The marriage to Bothwell seems like it may have been coerced, but it was a huge European scandal and basically led to her forced abdication. I appreciate trying to see through the bias against female rulers, but Mary deserves a higher score.
Yes.
Well, I think we did the similar thing for Elizabeth. She got quite a low scandal score, despite the fact there's quite a lot of juicy stuff. And maybe our lesson, you know, if we were, say, to do more reviewing of female figures in history in the future, that maybe we need to be a little bit more accepting of the scurrilous rumour. Because although it's good to point out that, you know, history is written by A, the winners, and B, men. You know, the likes of William Rufus, all those fun stories with his pointy shoes and mood lighting that the monks wrote, might not all have been true. But we were like, oh, this is fun. Scandal.
Yeah, scandal. Yeah, true.
So actually, if there is scandal, you know, they may not be guilty of it, but actually it is still a scandalous thing going on. And maybe we should still be giving these points for scandal, even though we acknowledge that some of this may just be scurrilous male writers.
And we're,
because otherwise we're just not going to give any women high scandal scores because we're a bit too reasonable.
Exactly, we're too reasonable, whereas with the blokes we're very happy to accept it. All right, good point.
So that is it for James VI. He does have the Rex Factor, and he will join the other 12 Scottish monarchs in the playoffs, which will be coming relatively soon. We will not be waiting another 2 months. I don't have
Was it 2 months?
But obviously I've done all the research already, so I don't have to do too much reading of books whilst also bringing up baby. So we will be back with the playoffs. The next episode will be the playoff draw, where we find out how that system is going to work, who's fighting off against who, and then we'll see who'll be crowned the X Factor champion of Scotland.
Exciting.
But until then, it's goodbye from me.
Cheerio.